Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. State lawmakers return to the State House this week with the biennial budget among their top priorities. The budget's a two-year spending plan. It covers everything from local government funds and K-12 education to policies that address the opioid crisis and much, much more. In recent years, what has been proposed by the governor has not made much impact. That might change with newly minted Republican Governor Mike DeWine at the helm. Coming up, we're going to hear from National Association of State Budget Officers and two groups that have worked to influence budget priorities in Ohio over the years. Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel covers the budget process. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
How does the governor, going to propose his budget in March. Who's working on that right now? Who does that?
Well, right now it's mostly the governor's state budget office, the Office of Budget and Management, and state agencies are told to submit proposals for their budgets, usually a different amount. Sometimes they're told, send me a flat budget amount. Sometimes they're told, send me a budget, what it would look like if we cut you 3%, what it would look like if we gave you 3% more. Basically, it allows them to lay down what their programs would look like, what cuts or increases could be, what impacts those can have on whether you can do certain services anymore. And so they kind of compile all this together. The governor obviously has a lot of input on what his priorities are going to be. And really, that's what a budget document is. It's a giant document of your priorities as a leader. And you'll get all this put together. They'll also, at the same time, are trying to determine just how much revenue they think they're going to have. They'll use a variety of services to try to help them come up with a forecast for revenue. And they'll put the budget out together to match up those revenues. And like you said, as a new governor, he gets to March 15th, which is actually two or three weeks extra time than a governor would get if say he was serving his second term.
Do we know what the DeWine administration has asked its state agencies to come up with? I mean, have they asked for them to submit something with, you know, 2 or 3% cuts or anything like that?
You know what? I'm not entirely sure what they've asked for this time. Like I said, usually it's a couple different options, and I think the agency started doing this under while they were still under Kasich,
mm-hmm.
So that the process could get going. And I'm not sure what the governor has asked them to do. The good thing for Governor DeWine is that the economy has continued to trend in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem is when you come in, if you come into office and you're starting to see a downturn and you're going to have a funding crunch, then you really have to start worrying about, you know, where you're going to, you know, are you going to have to squeeze various agencies in order to balance the budget. But at this point, it doesn't appear that Mike DeWine is going to have to do that. In fact, there should be some extra money left at the end of this budget once again, because the past OBM director, Tim Keene, under John Kasich, was always very conservative with his numbers, and typically we ended up with a surplus at the end of each year because they got a little bit more revenue than they expected, and oftentimes there was a lot less Medicaid money spent than what was projected.
Now, Lieutenant Governor John Husted is supposed to be looking at efficiencies in state government, and that's, again, another, I don't want to say perennial, but, you know, every time there's a new administration, they're going to wring some more efficiencies out of it. Is that something that he plays a role in at all when it comes to putting the budget together?
I don't know how much that's really going to impact yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to look for efficiencies, that's great, but I'm not sure how you can really factor that into your budget this quickly, mm-hmm. even if there are things that he finds that ultimately save money. I would be surprised if they're already down the road far enough that they can put that in a budget, because that'll often take, take actual changes in the law, changes in rulemaking, processes, how agencies work, you know, either by themselves or together. And I would just be surprised if that had an impact on this budget. But it certainly could have an impact down the road, depending on what he's able to do.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. He covers the state's two-year budget the process by which it's developed, that is to say, if you have a question or comment. That's what we're talking about this hour, the state budget, how it works, how it's put together. Coming up, we're going to talk to two different groups, one left-leaning, one right-leaning, about how they try to influence the budget process. 614-292-8513 is the number to call, and you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, how the governor has worked with the legislature in recent years has come into play quite a bit. Former Governor John Kasich didn't have a good reputation on that score. What are your expectations for how that might change under Mike DeWine?
Well, as far as I know, Mike DeWine gets along pretty well with the legislature at this, you know, and I don't mean that. Because obviously they haven't really done much together yet at all.
But he has been frankly, in state office, yeah.
Sure, and he's well known and generally well liked. He's not known for having the prickly personality that John Kasich did. John Kasich came in. He had things he wanted to get done, and he was not subtle about attempting to push some of these items. I don't think. You're going to see Mike DeWine pushing some of the more, you know, controversial things that the kind of things like John Kasich did over the years, such as, Kasich was in a years-long fight with the oil and gas industry, for example, over how much we should be taxing them to take oil and gas out of the ground. He wanted to raise that. The legislature did not. It was just every budget. It was a fight. Mm-hmm. I have not heard yet of Mike DeWine proposing anything along those lines that would stir up the legislature at this point. I think they're going to start off with a pretty good relationship. And again, it's, you know, when the revenues are trending in the right direction for you, it makes it easier on everyone. When you're not having to make the tough decisions on what to cut, but rather make the decisions on where to distribute the additional money, those conversations are a lot easier to have.
Except when it comes to transportation budget in Ohio this year, that looks like a place where they might have to make some hard decisions. Why, first of all, is the state transportation budget separate from the larger two-year spending plan?
It's always been that way. Mm-hmm. It's funded separately by the, you know, almost, you know, largely by the gas tax, along with federal, state gas tax, federal gas tax. It's always been considered separate because they, you know, it's just a kind of a separate pool of money with a completely separate purpose. I think it's just easier in some respects to kind of break that out and focus on that specifically rather than try to do that along with figuring out what to do with Medicaid and K-12 funding and all that mixed together. Normally the transportation budget is not a very heavy lift. It's the governor usually introduces it. There's a few tweaks here and there on money, but then it's usually passed in a couple weeks. But as you said, this time it's going to be a lot different because the state has flat out run out of money for new major road projects. The state did bonding against future turnpike revenues back in 2013 that raised about $1.5 billion, and that money is done. We're done with that, and now with that money running out, and the fact that the gas tax has not been increased since 2005. It's at 28 cents a gallon for Ohio, and so it's basically we're starting to run low on funds for local government, and like I said, for the major interstate projects going forward, there just is no more money for that. And there's actually a Governor DeWine has formed a committee that has actually just started meeting here about 10 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. I'll be heading to that here soon, where they are going to try to figure out what are the options. And the most obvious option is to simply raise the gas tax.
And the Speaker of the House, Larry Householder, has said that he's willing to consider that as well?
Yes. And in fact, both leaders, I mean, Senate President Larry Obhoff has been a little less enthusiastic, I would say, about this idea. But I think both chambers leaders are quickly coming to the realization that, at least in the short term, they may have to raise the gas tax in order to continue funding these major road projects. And now everyone seems to have the same position that on the long term, we're going to have to find some better ways to fund roads rather than the gas tax, simply because more and more people are starting to buy these fuel efficient cars, these electric cars. and we need to find a better way to ensure that everybody's paying their fair share to keep our roads upgraded, and also in order to fund some of the technology in the future, smart roads and hyperloops or whatever rail initiatives folks may come up with. But in the short term, those kind of things just aren't really going to do much in terms of revenue. From what folks tell me, the options for revenue in the next few years is fairly limited, and that's mainly to the gas tax, which, by the way, Ohio's gas tax is low, is 6 cents lower than the national average, and is lower than every surrounding state except for Kentucky.
Some costs are fixed in the operating budget, the point being that lawmakers can't really tweak those. The prison system, you have to pay for what you have to pay for, and Medicaid, those are the biggest ones, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I suppose you can tweak just about anything.
Well, true.
And you can let all the prisoners out and decide that we're not going to fund that anymore. But on a realistic level, I mean, look, 90% of the state budget goes to only a handful of items. Medicaid is about 47%. Then you have K-12 education at 24%. And then from there, it's higher ed, prisons and criminal justice, and then property tax rollbacks, which the state, at least for past levies, has paid a certain portion of those local property taxes that are approved. They don't pick up any of the new levies, but they used to. And those items add up to about 90% of the budget. So, those are your big spending items. That's where the focus is going to be, particularly Medicaid. You know, obviously there was a big fight for years over Medicaid expansion that mm-hmm. Governor Kasich pushed for. There's been a long-running concern that, are the Medicaid rolls growing or not, and is it going to eat up all the budget? Well, it has continued to grow, but again, that's also a problem with Ohio's, economy and income levels, which and jobs over the years. But, K-12 education is going to be a major issue this mm-hmm. year. Governor DeWine and especially in the House, the House Republicans are expected to come up with a new school funding plan that could have some not small costs attached to them once they're done. And once they're trying to figure out exactly what it really costs to educate a child, something Governor Kasich was never interested in trying to determine, there could be a big ask for more money there, among other things. So that's where your money goes. And so when you're talking about, like we said earlier, about efficiencies and making, there are certainly ways to do that. But at the end of the day, the bulk of the budget is what it is. It's just, you got to just decide how much you're going to allocate to schools and universities and such. But it's still going to cost money.
Jack and Mommy, you're on the air with the Dispatch reporter, Jim Siegel. Hi, Jack.
Yes, I just had a question regarding the Ohio surplus of, last time I read, was $3 billion. John Kasich was still running for president during his term in office. He drained all the funds from the towns and cities. Of course, the roads are right up there with Michigan roads, disgraceful. So is there any plan to use some of the $3 billion surplus that last time I heard? How much do you need in a rainy day fund? And, yeah. What are we going to do about the schools?
Okay.
Toledo Public Schools.
Well, that's a lot, Jack. Let's slow down. First of all, I thought it was closer to $2.6 billion. But is it around $3 billion, that rainy day fund?
It's about $2.7 billion,
actually. Oh, $2.7 billion. Okay.
There's always talk. Yes, there's talk every budget about and every year about, should we use some of that? In recent years, it's been, should we use some of it to help battle the opioid crisis we've had mm-hmm. with the overdose crisis that's been killing thousands of people each year in Ohio. But there will be talk of, is it time to tap that fund again? The problem with tapping that fund in terms of the budget is that it's essentially one-time money. Because once it's not an ongoing revenue stream, so you want to try to avoid using the rainy day fund to fund things that are going to be need, you know, that you're going to need to keep paying for years and years, because once you use that to fill a hole this year, then it's going to, that's fine, but then you'll have the same hole again next year if that money's gone. So, but no, there, I mean, it, $2.7 billion, it's almost full. There will definitely be talk of whether to use it for, to attack certain problems in the state. There are some who believe that it's just not necessary to have that big of a fund. Others say, no, this is there in case we hit a downturn, which is almost inevitable at some point. And so, you know, John Kasich was very much against ever touching that money. I don't think Mike DeWine has much interest in doing it either, but I'm not sure he's as adamant about it as John Kasich was.
I know I'm running over with you, Jim Siegel, but there's two things I wanted to get at, and that was something that Jack from Maumee mentioned, and that's a local government fund. Governor DeWine said last week that he didn't have a quote-unquote magic wand to solve that problem. But, I mean, why can't they start to return some of the funding to local governments now that the Budget Stabilization Fund, the Rainy Day Fund, exceeds $2.7 billion? That's how they pretty much built it up on the backs of local government, did they not?
Well, sure, that was part of it. I mean, part of the way they were balancing the budget before, especially when we went through the Great Recession, was they cut state local government funds basically in half. Hundreds of millions of dollars per year were lost that the state distributes to cities and townships and counties. Townships especially rely on it pretty heavily. It's right now it's about $393 million they give. Again, that's less than half of what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So restoring that money, I mean, it depends on what your definition of restore is.
Mm-hmm.
Restore it to what exactly?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're going to restore it back to the days, you know, from 10 years, 12 years ago, yeah, you're going to have to find a whole lot of money to do that. And I highly doubt that's going to be the case. However, you certainly could, you know, lawmakers certainly could find ways to increase that amount significantly. You know, it's just a matter of, again, it's a matter of distributing the money and what are your priorities? Because there's going to be a lot of, as usual, there's a lot of folks, K-12 education among them, that are going to be looking for additional funding. K-12 education funding has not kept pace with inflation over the last few years. So there's a line, but yeah, Larry Householder has indicated that he's interested in doing more for local government funding, as has the governor. So we'll see if that becomes more of a priority. John Kasich really did not like distributing that money to local governments, and it showed in his budgets.
And then one more thing is the still unresolved solvency of the state's unemployment compensation fund. I should say the long-term solvency. Is there any line item in the budget that might deal with that?
No, not really. That's,
okay.
That's mostly
separate
non-GRF item.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't really affect this budget. The fund is what it is. It's built up. It pays out benefits to the unemployed. But then, once again, as soon as we go into a downturn again, that fund is going to quickly run out of money, and we're going to be borrowing from the feds, and we're going to be right back in the hole where we were back at the Great Recession. And because they just have not yet come up with a fix that they're willing to pass, and that can has been kicked down the road many, many times.
Mm-hmm. Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to do it.
Jim Siegel, Columbus Dispatch State House reporter. He covers the budget process. We're going to turn to the National Association of State Budget Officials to talk about how Ohio stacks up nationally and how the process works in other places. So stay with us if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The two-year state budget covers everything from prisons to local government funds, K-12 education, to policies that address the opioid crisis, and much more. Republican Governor Mike DeWine is set to send his plan to the Ohio General Assembly by March 15th. That's 2 weeks later, about later than what's typical. He is new to the office, and they get an extra break on that score. We're talking about how a state budget typically works and who's involved. Coming up, we're going to hear from two groups that traditionally work to influence the process of state spending. That over the next 2 years likely will exceed $65 billion, and that is not counting the transportation budget. Or as Jim Siegel of the Dispatch told us earlier, the State Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund, or the fund for that. Joining us, Catherine Vesey-White is the Director of Budget Process Studies for the National Association of State Budget Officers in Washington, D.C. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Catherine White.
Thank you, Anne. Happy to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
How does a state budget reflect a state's overall health, to rating agencies? Who looks at a state budget? What does it say?
Sure. So a state budget certainly can tell you a lot about a state's fiscal health in combination with looking at other state documents, financial statements. They're the CAFR that is produced, more of a retroactive look back. But the state budget is really the chief planning document that will tell interested parties, including rating agencies, what the budget outlook is, where the state is intending to spend its resources, and of course, what the state expects to collect in revenues. The budget is built based on a revenue forecast that the state produces, and the exact way in which revenue forecasting happens state to state does vary, but it can tell you a lot but the way in which it's presented is often variable state to state.
What do you mean the way in which it's presented?
So, states have there's no standard presentation format for a state budget. We at the National Association of State Budget Officers, as the membership organization for the governor's budget offices, especially pay attention to the way the executive budget put together. So we're talking about the governor's budget recommendation, as you alluded to, the one that the new Ohio governor will be putting out in March. There's really no standard format. So a state has some discretion in terms of how what content they include, but all budgets will present in some form, what the state intends to spend, particularly from the state's general fund, or in the case of Ohio, they refer to it as the general revenue fund. The level of detail that is included in the budget recommendation, whether the budget also includes capital expenditures or whether that's treated separately in a separate budget document. This is just a few of the many ways that states vary in terms of the presentation of materials.
2018 was a good year for many state treasuries, and rainy day funds reflected that, or as we call it, I can't remember what we call it now all of a sudden.
The budget
stabilization fund, yeah.
Yes.
It's extra money in case we have an emergency fund. And I was wondering how important those cash reserves are, particularly in the wake of the Great Recession.
Sure. No, that's a great question, and certainly very top of mind for state budget officials and chief executives right now, as we are, in one of the longest recovery cycles in modern history. There is an expectation that these rainy day funds may be needed in the not too distant future. And so states have really, we've seen, particularly in the last couple of years, and like you said, 2018 was a good year revenue-wise for states. And so we've seen an emphasis placed on building up those rainy day funds because they did prove to be useful, definitely useful during the last recession. Most states did tap into them quite a bit. And so their balances were very low coming out of the Great Recession. But they have done really prioritized building those back up. So we've seen the median rainy day fund balance, for example, was across all 50 states, was at 1.6% at the end of fiscal year 2010. And we've now seen it up to around 6.4% coming out of fiscal 2018.
And that's a percent of the general fund.
That is as a share of general fund spending. Yes. Yes.
Is there a tipping point that state budget officials look at when it comes to getting that rainy day fund to a healthy place, but also avoiding, doing damage other places in the budget?
Right. Sure. And it's important to note that with any recession, the rainy day fund is one of the tools in a state toolbox in terms of responding to the economic and the revenue downturn. There are other tools, spending reductions, potential revenue increases, and other one-time strategies that states will use to manage their budgets. But the rainy day fund, in terms of a threshold, historically, if you look at the literature, numbers like 5% or sometimes higher have been thrown around. But we're now seeing that states are really, and rating agencies would, I think, agree with this. It's really important to look at the specific, on it at a case-by-case basis, how volatile is that particular state's revenue structure. We've seen for many years now, oil and gas dependent states like Alaska, Nebraska, and other states that I meant to say Oklahoma, North Dakota, they've had to put more money into savings because their revenue streams are so volatile. Other states have also seen their revenue structures grow increasingly volatile as they become more dependent on personal income tax collections, particularly from non-withholding sources. So we've seen some states do revenue volatility studies and then build their rainy day fund policies and target sizes based off of those studies. And so there's really no one target, I think, that we would say is applicable to all states. It's really on a case-by-case basis. And we're seeing states think a lot more deliberately about how these policies should be structured. And as I think your last speaker mentioned, there's also when a state has a surplus at the end of a year, an unanticipated surplus, there's often a built-in transfer to a rainy day fund of at least a portion of that because it is one-time money and generally it's advisable not to use one-time money for recurring expenditures.
Not to use unexpected money.
Unexpected.
One time. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
In Ohio, local government funds have been reduced significantly over the past decade to help the bottom line during the recession. The local government fund line item was established during the Great Depression to create some stability for local governments that have to rely on voters for levy increases and therefore have less stability. Is that a typical arrangement across the country? Because it's going to be a bone of contention in the next year or two in Ohio. And I'm wondering, is this playing out in other places?
We do collect some data on this, more qualitative than quantitative. But, we did certainly see Across the country, there being reductions in local aid in the wake of the Great Recession. That was one way that that's one of those tools that among many that I mentioned earlier that states relied on. And since then, you know, it's really varied. The way the level of direct aid to local governments that a state provides is quite variable. Not all states would have that particular line item you're referring to.
Okay.
You know, there's different revenue sharing between state and locals takes on different forms.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's also you know, the biggest program area where you see the state local funding relationship play out is in K-12 education. So there's also a lot of variance in terms of, you know, in many places, that's the primary way that the state handles its level of support for localities. So it really does vary. But I will say that I don't think Ohio is unique in having that debate around local aid and what has happened since the recession.
Catherine White, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate you having me again. Thank you.
Catherine Vesey White, she's director of the Budget Process Studies for the National Association of State Budget Officers in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we're going to hear from two different groups about how they think the budget process works and when it doesn't work, and how they work to influence and what their top priorities are this year. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the two-year state budget. The governor kicks off the process, and Governor DeWine is set to send his plan to the Ohio General Assembly by March 15th. He gets a few extra weeks because he's new on the job. After that, first the House and then the Senate, between them, have until June 30th to adopt some version of that plan. Lots of special interest organizations work to influence the process, and we invited representatives of two of those groups to talk about their priorities and how they work to influence the budget. Wendy Patton is Senior Project Director for Policy Matters Ohio. It's a liberal think tank based in Columbus. Welcome back, Wendy Patton.
Thanks so much, Ann.
And Greg Lawson is Senior Policy Analyst at the Buckeye Institute, a conservative think tank. He joins us by phone. Welcome back, Greg.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Still, you know, I guess I was wondering for you both to just start off, and as briefly as possible, kind of tell us what your priorities are, what you're walking into this budget-making process with. Greg Lawson?
Sure. Well, one of the first things, we know where the Governor DeWine's priorities are. He was pretty clear in the campaign that he was very focused on a lot of issues regarding children. So we anticipate a lot of funding to go to things like pre-K. We know there's going to be modifications to the school funding formula. So we anticipate all of that. I think what we'd like to see is that we are sure that the programs where that money is being directed are effective. You can always put money into something that doesn't always mean that it works the way that we want. We get the good outcomes that we expect. So I think that's probably the first priority there. But there's a number of other issues since the budget touches so much. There's a lot of issues with the criminal justice system and the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. It's a big budget item. We want to see some work done on there to try to alleviate some of the costs there.
Well, and that's considered a relatively fixed amount in that, you know, you've got the housing, the whole prison system is what it is. What do you mean by cutting back on that? Like, such as?
Well, there's some changes to how we do things, and this is a broader issue with criminal justice reform. There's a whole host of issues. Some of them are budget related. Some of them are a little are different, but interrelated to the degree that we still have a higher population than we think we should have being housed in the prison system. So we'd like to find some ways to get people who are, quite frankly, a lot of people who are in there for drug use offenses, as opposed to trafficking and bad things like that. We certainly think people like that need to be in prison. But for people who are caught up and need to be treated, prison is not the right place.
Okay.
We need to try to find ways to get folks out of there. And then also Medicaid. I mean, Medicaid is, as Governor Voinovich said something like 20-plus years ago, it's the Pac-Man of the state budget. It still is. It's one of the, it is the single largest. We look at all the federal funds that come in as well. We feel that we need to do some things. I think Wendy would probably disagree with some of the areas we want to go, but we need to find ways to get, especially the group aid or the expansion population. We need to try to transition people off of there to make sure that they're in the gainfully employed situations. And also, first of all, that's the right thing to do for individuals. And secondly, there is obviously a budgetary impact there, too.
All right. And Wendy Patton, from where you sit at the Policy Matters Ohio, what are a couple of the big pieces you want to work on?
We've seen the economy change since the recession, and we've seen inequality grow. We've seen Ohio's 10 largest occupational groups leave a full-time worker at the medium wage, needing and eligible for and needing public assistance. Investment in the kinds of programs that can move people forward and opportunity have been sacrificed to an austerity budget and to tax cuts really for the last 14 years. That includes the recession. So we are looking to the kind of restoration that Governor DeWine has spoken of in his campaign platform for child care assistance, for example. It's harder to get help with the high cost of child care for low-wage workers than in 49 other states. We're looking for programs that will help in important health areas like infant mortality. The governor has addressed that. We're very concerned about retaining the Medicaid expansion, which largely serves a working population, but people that get uneven hours. So the work requirements issue is going to knock people out of health care instead of moving them forward to better employment or something. This is a way in which Medicaid expansion gets hollowed out. So protecting the Medicaid expansion and the health care that's necessary to help people work is very important to us. And finally, I'd mention education reform, which Speaker Householder has also addressed as being an issue that we want to see the legislature move forward on.
That's a huge policy issue in and of itself.
It is.
It's hard to even think about. I mean, it's been 30 years now.
This is delayed
since DeRolf.
We have delayed the maintenance of important systems like our public schools for far too long, and now they look like really huge problems. They can be fixed and they can be addressed by addressing some of the holes and problems within our tax revenue system, in particular, the tax breaks. I think Greg and I agree on this one. Tax breaks have proliferated in the Ohio budget. By now, the state spends more on tax breaks than we send out to our local school districts, more than $9 billion a year. Need to tighten some of that up, and some could pay for education reform.
I'm thinking that you probably also have some common ground when it comes to the prison population and how to move that around and change that dynamic.
We did the research behind issue one and had a set of four very good approaches to addressing changes in the prison population. We disagree with Greg's contention that fixed costs are the largest cost in the ODR system. There are huge labor costs, which as you move people out of the system, the labor costs come down. That's where some of the savings come from. We think that moving sentencing reform for low-level drug possession with a return of that money for treatment. The issue is treatment to the community.
It's a shifting of money. It's not.
It's a
shifting of priorities. All right. So, Greg Lawson, tell people how you do your job. How do you work on influencing the legislature, the executive branch on these issues?
Well, we talk to folks. I think that's the first thing that we need to do is we need to find out where everybody's priorities are, understand the reality on the ground, I mean, we're a think tank. We have two PhD economists, a master's economist in-house at the Buckeye Institute that does a lot of fancy stuff with Greek lettering on their whiteboard, you know, in their office that makes me get intimidated when I go by there. But they run a variety of different kinds of simulations to look at how different taxing or spending policies will impact the economy. So we run things like that. We have a number of other researchers. I myself do work on education and local government issues. That's actually another issue that we would probably be paying quite a bit of attention to is the local government fund.
Right.
You know, we do research. We run the numbers through our systems and our econometric modeling. And then we take this information and we share it with policymakers. We want to educate folks. We want to be a resource for folks. We understand that they're going to get information from a variety of places. They're going to get information from the folks who draft the bills, the Legislative Service Commission.
Uh-huh.
They're going to get it from folks like Wendy and Policy Matters. But we want to be a part of the conversation. We want to take what we have and have an ongoing dialogue. So I think it's about making sure we get good information. That's actually first and foremost the most important thing. The second thing is developing relationships where people know that they can ask us questions and that we will be responsive. And that they, when they want to try to understand what a given policy would be, what does that mean? What are other states doing too? And we try to call on a lot of different resources that even if we don't have it in house, we're within kind of a constellation of folks that we talk to, even in Washington. And so it's being a purveyor of appropriate information, trust that they can trust, and then listening.
You know, Wendy Patton, it's Ohio General Assembly's a huge Republican majority in the Ohio General Assembly. Increasingly conservative. You could go back 20 years. It's like a different, the numbers are more Republicans, but not just more Republicans, more conservative Republicans. How do you do your job in a body like that, being a liberal kind of think tank?
We work with people on both sides of the aisle. We have relationships on both sides of the aisle. There are good people on both sides of the aisle. And so we have relationships and we go visit people on important issues. We tell them our point of view, and we have ongoing input with people throughout the legislature. We are a nonpartisan organization.
Right.
We work with coalitions, and our approach to the budget is a deep dive into the data, deep understanding of the information that the agencies give us. And then we work closely with the coalitions of people who are interested in the kinds of issues we are. We know what their interests and policy needs are. We also work with grassroots organizations so that we know what the interests of the, you know, people on the street are. And we focus our attention on issues that we learn from our coalition partners and we learn from our grassroots partners. And we do studies on those kinds of issues. We take them back to our coalitions. We go out and talk to people across the state. I did a speech last night. We're doing a speech, you know, in central Ohio on March 3rd on the budget process. We'll go to Dayton after that. We are all over the state talking to people and doing outreach on specific issues.
And I wanted to ask both of you how, you know, you kind of described it, your constituency is it's everybody. It's everybody out there. And Greg, I'm sure you'd probably say the same thing. But how much interest do everyday people have in the topic of the state budget?
I can tell you that I think this year interest in the state budget is huge. I spoke at a meeting of the Clintonville Indivisibles on Sunday, and there were 75 people in the room. They wanted to learn about the budget process. They were listening to experts on how do you approach your legislature and what is the timing and, you know, where do you find information? Great interest in this budget period.
And Greg Lawson, what's your sense about that?
I actually echo a lot of what Wendy just said. I think that there's groups that are out there that have an intense interest. I've, you know, done various things across the state, too, where you go to different groups and you try to train people and let people understand. There's a copious amount of data that's out there, but sometimes it's in different places, and you have to be able to pull all of that together and kind of put it into a package to make sense of it. And so trying to go out and train people, especially like school funding, for example, is such a complicated thing because you've got the school, the state issues and the state funding, but how the local taxes impacts that and how the local taxes impact what the state gives.
And you got to educate people as to this and reaching out. So I think it's there is an interest, especially on schools. I think school funding is probably the thing everybody really pays a lot of attention to, no matter what kind of district they're from. People care what the money is, how much is being spent. They care about how it's being spent. And I think that's probably the thing that you get the most excited about. Then I will say we've done, one of my colleagues is actually focused exclusively or almost exclusively on criminal justice issues. And he's gone around the state and done quite a bit with different groups. Some of them are the same groups as Policy Matters. And I think actually we share probably on that issue. I bet we're probably 75-80% in agreement with Policy Matters on stuff relative to that.
Yeah.
And so I think there is a great interest on the different issues. I think when you look at schools, when you look at prisons, and Medicaid and healthcare in general, I think that there is a great interest out there amongst the grassroots to understand things and to realize what this process really is like.
I wanted to bring up, you know, you brought up, both of you brought up the local government fund. Wendy, you've written that by 2018, counties, cities, townships, and villages lost $1.4 billion a year since 2006, as the state cut the local government fund, phased out tax reimbursements, and eliminated some local taxes. I guess that would include the inheritance tax and that kind of a thing was a big hit. But Greg Lawson, what about the local government fund? Where does Buckeye Institute stand on that score?
We don't want to see an increase in the local government.
Why?
What we would prefer to see, well, a couple of reasons. One is that if there is going to be an increase, it should be targeted to the entities that have a difficult time raising money themselves locally.
Like townships.
Townships in particular, because they don't have the piggyback sales tax that counties right. have and the municipal income tax. So, yes, definitely townships. And then also, I think you have to look at and the capacity even within townships. I mean, townships are pretty – there's a wide range of types of townships. You go to southwest Ohio, you've got townships that could be a city six, seven, eight times over. Mm-hmm. And you go up to other parts and you're talking about, you know, lucky if you get 1,000 people in a township. So, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all situation. And I think one of the things we'd like to see is we do recognize that with things like the opioid crisis – and stuff of that nature, and infrastructure, too, for that matter, is a very big issue, not just roads, which is kind of a hot topic right now with the gas tax debate heating up, but just fixing sewers and things like that, not sexy items, but things that are extremely important. We'd like to see, we recognize that there's a need for that, but those should be kind of targeted. The way the local government fund works is it goes into sort of a pot, and locals
decide.
Do a lot of different things with it. And so we want to make sure that it's being used on things that definitely have a statewide interest. And if there's a local issue and they have the capacity to raise the money at the local level, we want to see people raising money at the local level.
Yeah. And Wendy Patton?
The local government fund was always structured to address diversity across Ohio's 88 counties. The state did not take a top-down look at what local counties should be doing for people. They said, we will give you funds and you need to meet the needs of your people. As a result of that model, many counties did the lion's share of important social services and other services like public transit that other states, the state picks up the fund. So we had a sudden cut of the local government funds and other sources of revenue for counties without fixing the fact that the locals have been responsible for far too great of a share of important services like the child protective services. In some counties, there's a great struggle to meet the welfare needs of children. Most states will put more. Ohio is the 50th in the amount of money the state puts into the child protective service. The local government funds were to allow counties to decide how to use those monies. Maybe they'd need it for protective services, maybe something else, but it was a flexible system. Now the local government fund has been cut, but the state has not stepped up to take the other financial needs off the backs of counties and cities and municipalities and townships. So we have an unbalanced system. There needs to be restoration of the local government fund, and the state needs to take a bigger share of some services that blow counties out of the water. Indigent legal defense is a good example of that. The public defender, Tim Young, spoke eloquently to that in his budget request letter. So we need to rebalance the system.
We actually echo that concern on the public defender. Actually, I think we agree, Wendy.
We agree on all these things today, Greg.
Wow. Greg Lawson, Senior Policy Analyst at Buckeye Institute. Thanks for joining us. And Wendy Patton, Senior Project Director for Policy Matters Ohio, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. It's a conversation that will continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.